Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code PERFORM.
Today in Studio 360, I'll talk with one of the biggest names in theater today, writer and director James Lapine, who's up for a Tony next weekend for his play Act One. If he wins, it'll be his fourth Tony, and he's got a Pulitzer. But he still feels underappreciated.
Book writing for a musical is a craft, and it's totally underrated. It's very, very difficult to do, and if you do your job well, you'll get no recognition for it.
And I'll talk with the actress Anika Noni Rose. She starred in Caroline or Change, and this year she's up for a Tony for her performance in A Raisin in the Sun. But enough with the serious roles on the serious stage. Rose wants to play a movie superhero.
Or a villain. I'll take out of town.
I want to fly and, like, bite somebody in the neck and then kick somebody else. Yeah.
That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Julian Lage picked up a guitar when he was 5 years old, and by the time he was 8, he was on stage with Carlos Santana. Now, at 26, he's played more gigs than a lot of musicians will in a lifetime. And he'll play for us later this hour. But to start the show, what happened 13 years ago on September 11th is the most consequential event of the century so far. So, naturally, no American building project has been more closely watched than the 9/11 memorial site in New York City. 3 years ago, we got the first pieces of the grand plan, two vast, deep, black pools where the Twin Towers stood. And now the fences around the whole 8-acre Memorial Plaza have come down, and the 9/11 Museum has opened. Michael Kimmelman is the architecture critic for the New York Times, and day after day for a while, he's been visiting the memorial. He's held his peace about it until now. Michael Kimmelman, welcome back to Studio 360.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Kurt.
So you've spent a lot of time there, and I take it you really are disappointed in how this memorial site works. Talk about that.
Listen, I have to begin by saying, of course, that I can't think of, and I don't think anyone else knows of, a more complex site in terms of dealing with the competing and very legitimate interests. And so balancing these interests between the victims' families, the real estate interests, and the neighborhood, the city as an urban fabric, is very complicated. And I think, you know, perhaps inevitably but unfortunately, that balance has not really been well struck. I don't think this is really a place that feels like it's part of New York and that represents the things we value in New York. You know, it's entirely peopled by tourists at this point. It's designed in such a way that it's not really inviting to New Yorkers who are going to have to use that site. And, you know, the list of don'ts on the site is astonishing. You can't sing, much less stage a protest or a demonstration. And I think that does raise some very profound questions about a site that is supposed to speak
to liberty.
Our liberties, yeah.
So for now, you feel as though they've turned the dial too far to the, this is a very sacred space in which you must do nothing. You may not laugh. You may not sing. It's too different than the rest of the hurly-burly of New York?
I don't want to sound like some, you know, crazy critic who comes in and says, I think that every place should be like
Times Square.
Central Park. Yeah. Times Square. Nor am I saying that there isn't something very unique and of course troubling about this place. This is the place where people died. It's not just a memorial.
Which is something we've never had to deal with since the Civil War, you know,
yeah,
right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. So, of course, I do understand this. You know, one of the most interesting things about memorials generally is that the debate around them is the most democratic and hopeful thing that they produce. Maybe that's one way of looking at it.
I wonder if, given that the great memorial of our time was the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington 30 years ago, and if maybe the wrong lessons or not the right lessons were learned from that, maybe? Because that was built on the Washington Mall, not in the smack dab in the middle of any real urban life. But it seems as though they were trying to replicate that feeling of gravity and solemnity.
I think that's a very interesting comparison. First of all, that's postage stamp size by comparison, though. What happened there was this extraordinary meeting of a kind of language of what you might call monumental minimalism. That kind of abstraction allowed people to say and think what they wanted about the war. But then the lists of names provided a kind of literalness that added this deeply personal element. It was quite an extraordinary marriage of these two seeming opposites. And I think that's part of what has made that place powerful. It's now become a kind of repeated device, the large abstract thing, in this case the fountain at Ground Zero, with the literal list of names. And, you know, I think that it worked at Vietnam partly because that's a relatively intimate site, at least by comparison.
Yes, it's a very human-scaled site, yeah.
Very. You know, but I think here there was a desire to do something really huge. You know, there was a lot of expectation for what this site might become. You know, I have to keep coming back to say, I think the ability of New York and by extension America to return again to life and return this place to life would have been a very remarkable and powerful statement about our resilience and about democracy in general.
Well, and the train station, which is this $3.5 billion thing designed by Santiago Calatrava, is going to open at the end of next year. And it's already looking pretty extraordinary and just as an object, unlike the boxes that are there now. And it's a train station with tens of thousands of people using it every day. Mightn't that enliven the whole place?
I think so. And, of course, you're generously saying $3.5 billion. It's probably going to be north of $4 billion. But, yes, I do think it's going to create, a very striking object. It looks like a giant, I don't know, like a dinosaur skeleton parked there at the corner of this site. It's in some ways the most remarkable piece of architecture on what has become a place that, in fact, doesn't have much great architecture. And there had been hopes for that, too. And that banality is an unfortunate thing.
Michael Kimmelman, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Kurt.
Michael Kimmelman is chief architecture critic for the New York Times. Have you been to the September 11th memorial or the new museum? Were you moved or disappointed or maybe both? Tell us about your experiences there at studio360.org.
Wondering where her easy rider's gone.
A few weeks ago, we asked you to record and send us your cover version of an old classic. W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues, a song that's a century old this year. Allison Leighton Brown of New York City sent us this classic take, which happens to feature Tony-nominated singer Allison Frazier.
Letters come from down in Bama.
And we got this highly 21st century version from Kelly Pratt, a guy who records as Bright Moments. Still got time to send us your version. We've extended the deadline to June 16th at midnight. Mark Anthony Thompson, the songwriter behind Chocolate Genius, will pick our winner. All the information is at studio360.org. Coming up right now,
there are worse things than staring at the moon.
people who care about theater love Sunday in the Park with George, Stephen Sondheim's 1984 musical. But the young newbie who wrote the book for the musical, he wasn't so sure about it.
I didn't know it was going to go anywhere. I was still so new to the theater that I figured, well, I'll go back and be a graphic designer if this little thing doesn't turn out so well.
I'll talk with James Lapine later this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. And by Hover, helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code PERFORM.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. This week, in our new sibling podcast Sideshow, we go deep into cultural service journalism, how to send the perfect GIF for every occasion. That's GIF, G-I-F, not gift.
My favorite reaction GIF, and I save this one for special occasions, features President Obama's head on Beyonce's body, but it's Beyonce's body from the Single Ladies video, and it's just a stencil outline of it. She's doing that sassy dance with one hand waving in the air and the other one on her waist, but with Barack Obama's smiling face, all while standing on a giant revolving pizza. And it's set somewhere in outer space.
You can keep up with what we're doing on Sideshow at studio360.org/sideshow. I first encountered Anika Noni Rose a decade ago, acting and singing wonderfully in Tony Kushner's Caroline or Change. But probably more people these days know her voice than her face. Because in 2009, she was Princess Tiana in The Princess and the Frog, the first major role for a black actress in an animated Disney film. Now, she's starring in a new movie, Half of a Yellow Sun, based on the novel about the Nigerian Civil War by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And she's up for a Tony next weekend for her role in the current Broadway revival of A Raisin in the Sun. She plays Benita, an ambitious undergraduate who's wanted to be a doctor ever since she saw a neighborhood kid fall and split open his head.
The ambulance came, and they took him to the hospital, and they fixed up the broken bones, and they sewed it all up. And the next time I saw Rufus, he just had a little line down the middle of his face. I never got over that.
What?
That was what one human being could do for another. Fix him up. You know, sew up the problem, make him all right again. That was the most marvelous thing in the world, and I wanted to do that.
You know, Lorraine Hansberry was a genius. She wrote this play at 28 years old. And, you know, you think, what were we doing at 28 years old?
Not that.
Not that. You know, and she was so far ahead of her time. And Benita is really an expression of Lorraine.
Like, for instance, what?
Well, when she talks about not believing in God. Lorraine Hansberry did not believe in God, but what she did have was a very strong respect for people who did believe in God and for how religion allowed people to get through the worst of times.
There is a brilliant moment among many when she steps out of her room in traditional Nigerian dress, or what she imagines, I guess, mm-hmm. is traditional Nigerian robes, including a bright headscarf, and you dance. Is Benita expressing her true self? Is it a political statement, or is she a girl sort of in love with a boy?
I think she's a girl in love with a boy. I think she's a girl falling in love with another culture and another piece of herself that she wasn't necessarily aware of. And yet you see in the dance that she is still that little girl, and you see a freedom within her. You get to really see her have fun within that moment.
Benita, the character you play, is 20. And on my way out of the theater, being just amazed and impressed by her performance, I Googled you and was astounded to find that you are not 20. Not by quite a bit.
If I didn't have this makeup on and I just walked in here quietly.
You'd look 70. No.
I would look 75. Now, I would, you know, you wouldn't know. And that's, you know, partially the gift of my parents. But also, you know, I don't think I've ever released that person. I don't think I've ever released that 5-year-old stepping off the bus to go to kindergarten in my orange and pink dress with matching bloomers. I know that person.
Yeah. Well, it just that in and of itself to me, even beyond, whoa, she can act really well. That was an astounding, quantifiable measure of your talent.
Thank you.
As a kid in the 1980s, let's say, when did you decide acting was the thing you wanted to do?
Oh, I was late. I did a musical in my high school. I mean, we didn't even have an arts program. Somebody came in and directed a musical, and I was on stage, and I said, oh, my, this is it. I stopped doing everything else. I stopped running track. I stopped playing instruments, everything. Huh. Screech! This is it. Nothing has felt like this. You know, I'd have friends who were like, yes, and I was in ballet from 18 months, and I just wasn't that person. I didn't want to even be looked at. Even after that performance, like, my mom would try to get me to perform for her friends. They sing for so-and-so, and I was like, absolutely not. I would have to turn around. They'd have to be in another room. Like, I couldn't stand being watched.
Really? It sounds like you're in the wrong job then.
I've managed to work on through.
I first encountered you playing another rebellious young woman in Tony Kushner's Carolina Change, for which you won a Tony Award. I want to play a clip from the end of that show.
I'm the daughter of a maid in her uniform, crisp and clean. Nothing can ever make me afraid. You can't hold on, you nightmare men. Your time is past now, on your way. Get gone and never come again. For change come fast and change come slow. But everything changes, and you got to go. Shout, shout, devil on out.
That is Anika Noni Rhodes once more proving her extraordinary range of abilities in the non-musical Carolina Change. You were in that play from the beginning when it was being developed out of nothing in workshops and being endlessly revised, as Tony Kushner tends to do with everything he writes. When you got to Tony in your acceptance speech, you said you'd worked on it for 3 years without getting paid a dime.
Well, we got a dime.
Okay,
but probably about a dime. Quarter.
Yeah. And did you just know, okay, this is the guy who did Angels in America. I like this piece. I'm just going to stick to it, even though it's not doesn't make financial sense.
I have to say that I'm in love with Tony Kushner. I love him. I love his brain. I love the way he sees people. I love the fact that he is smarter than any person in a room at any given time, but he never makes you feel that way. And he writes amazing women. And I knew once we started that I was going to take that as far as I could take it.
You just signed on for the duration.
I just was there for the ride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were starting out, you went to school, you were a trained actor, you moved to New York. What was your picture of success?
Having moved to New York after grad school, my goal was to take Broadway by storm. That's what I wanted to do.
Musical theater? Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. I just wanted to be on stage, and I love being on stage, and I love doing musicals. But I wanted to do film, and I wanted to do theater, and
I wanted to do From Justin to Kelly, American Idol movie.
Of course you know that was my goal.
Yes.
You know, but I
you were in a feature film, which was, in its way, a big movie at the time.
It was not a big movie.
Okay, I'm being generous.
Yes. But it did pay off a student loan.
Well, that's all
that
counts.
So there's that.
But since that movie, you've been in films, truly big films like Dreamgirls and For Colored Girls. And right now, you are in Half of a Yellow Sun, which takes place during the Nigerian Civil War. Talk about your role in this new movie.
I play a character named Kainene. I think she's an amazing woman. She's extraordinarily smart and strong, and she's a survivor, and a woman in war, which is a time where I think women are more vulnerable than any other time. From the rape of the Sabine women on, we are always the commodity. We are always something with which to trade, as we are looking at now
with Boko
Haram in Nigeria. And the bottom line is that women are once again the pawn.
Yep.
But Kainene is somebody who is not willing to be the pawn.
Right.
And she finds a way to be on top and to make sure that she survives and that her family survives. She is the one to make it happen in spite of all of these men around who are pontificating. She is quietly making things work.
You've also have this sub-career as an actor in animation.
Yes.
You are now known to all children as Princess Tiana in
yes.
Disney's The Princess and the Frog, and known to other people in addition as on The Simpsons as as Grandpa Simpson's songwriting partner and long-lost love,
yes.
Rita LaFleur, and I want to play a little bit of her.
Rita, you look dynamite.
And you look like you could use a good ironing, but I still love you. Take a seat. Yeah.
I get a jonesing in my bones when you strut across the room. Yeah, my liver starts to quiver, my intestines go boom. But tell the undertaker I ain't ready for no tomb. You're the penny in my loafers, the egg in my cream. Yeah, you knock me up, then you're the girl of my dreams.
So, playing an old woman, playing a young woman, that must have been fun.
It was so much fun. They really just let you off the leash in that room. They're like, just do what you want to do. So, I felt like she was this chanteuse from a different time. So I thought, absolutely, she'd say, yeah, at the end of things, because that's your junior song, yeah. I love voiceover work. I can tell you that was the thing that I first wanted to do. And I was a kid, so I didn't even think of it as acting. I just knew I wanted to be in a Disney film.
Really?
Oh, yes.
So that's been checked off your bucket list?
It's checked, but I'm not finished. I'm not finished. I'd like to do some things that are even less iconic that I can be a complete idiot while I'm doing it. You know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. I want to be a leaf on a tree that's about to fall because the seasons are changing.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? She's petrified all the
yeah.
time. She's like, hold it out like this. I don't want to go. You know?
Very good.
I want to do things like that.
Are there particular roles? I mean, obviously, you want to do everything. You want to do it all. But are there particular, I would love to do that kind of character that nobody's asked me to, or this kind of character?
I want to be a superhero. Or a villain. I'll take out of town. I'm not mad about that.
Yeah. You would like to be in one of those big green screen movies?
Oh, my God,
movies?
Yes. I want to fly and, like, bite somebody in the neck and then kick somebody else. Yeah, I do. That my mom said when I was little, I was about 2, she says, you know, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? 2 to 5. I said I wanted to be a veterinarian and a superhero. We got to check veterinarian off because I'm bad at math and I'll kill your animal by accident with the drug. but I still have room in my heart for the superhero or supervillain. I have always found that to be just ridiculously fun looking.
So when you're in Batman 12, you'll come back and talk to me again.
Absolutely.
Anika Noni Rose, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anika Noni Rose is starring on Broadway right now in A Raisin in the Sun. And watch the Tonys on June 8th. She is up for one.
That was fun.
For a young person looking to make it in the theater, getting a gig with Stephen Sondheim would seem like the brass ring had been duly grabbed. And sure enough, for writer and director James Lapine, it led to Tony Awards, a Pulitzer, a lifetime of work. Lapine is one of the Broadway A-listers of his generation. And his latest play is about one of the A-listers of an earlier Broadway generation, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Moss Hart, an impoverished immigrant kid who got his start working with George S. Kaufman. Hart published a best-selling memoir called Act One, a book that several generations of theater wannabes have read as an inspirational guidebook. Now, Lapine has turned that memoir about being a playwright into a play, which is running now at the Lincoln Center Theater, directed as well as written by James Lapine. James Lapine, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thanks. Great to be here.
Apart from the fact that they made some great theater together, what was particularly interesting to you about the Hart-Kaufman relationship?
I think what's interesting about it for me was they were from such extremely different worlds. This kid out of poverty who ends up, you know, going to the Upper East Side and at this townhouse. And I have to say I related to that, being a guy who lived down in the grunges of Wall Street before anyone lived there, and going up to Stephen Sondheim's house and being served lunch with a real napkin and silver was, you know, kind of an eye-opener. And I just connected to that in the book, and that's what I found interesting to delve into.
I want to play a bit of a scene from Act One. This is when Hart and his collaborator, mentor Kaufman are in the middle of developing the play that becomes Once in a Lifetime, and they can't get it right. And Kaufman, played by Tony Shalhoub, has just told Hart, played by Santino Fontana, that he's decided to give up on this show.
This is a great deal of work. These are major changes, and it's a huge gamble.
You already signed on for a huge gamble.
I did.
When you chose to work with me, I had no experience and no reputation. You could have chosen any number of other projects, and it would have been less of a gamble. But you said yes to Once in a Lifetime. You said yes to me. Now listen, you've been busy directing and acting in it, okay? And I haven't carried my weight. I expected you to have all the answers, and that wasn't fair to both of us. After the Herald review, you said that this was our play. I can't take it back or do it with someone else. I can't believe you even suggested that. I want a life in this business. That's all I've ever wanted. And I want to get this play up, and I want to get it right. And do it now, and with you. We're a good team. And we can fix this, George.
That's a young Moss Hart battling it out with Kaufman in James Lapine's play Act One. And this turns out to be a really rewarding creative partnership, which is surprising given the differences in age and that they were stuck together by a producer. It's really an arranged marriage, right?
Yeah, it was really – I often wonder why Kaufman did it. And frankly, my own personal experience of meeting Stephen Sondheim at a young age when he was a very established person – you know, now that I'm very mature, I understand that impulse to work with a younger person, and particularly one who may not be that experienced.
Yeah.
And I think they were such a great team because Hart, excuse the pun, had all the heart, and Kaufman had all the craft. And together, they became a very strong collaborative team once they were able to kind of find the middle ground for themselves to meet in the storytelling.
The Moss Hart that we see in this play is full of pluck and creativity,
yeah,
and
virtue, yeah,
youth. And the real Moss Hart had a tougher life from beginning to end, it sounds like. His childhood was worse than his book makes out or this play really depicts. He apparently could have been diagnosed with all kinds of then non-existent things like bipolar disorder. He was sexually confused, it seems. All of which seemed like such natural fodder for the theater, and you decided, I'm not going to go there?
Well, I felt I had to honor the book, you know, and the book is I'm not doing the Moss Hart story, you know. So I really, of course, read everything I could on him. But at the end of the day, I didn't feel it really figured into what I was doing because I was trying to make this book read, you know, and live on the stage and have its own life. And people who want to be inspired to find out more about him can.
Yeah.
But I was not about to psychoanalyze the character, right, and bring those elements
into
it.
Even though it's a real guy. On some level, although I guess it's a fictionalization of a fictionalization.
Yeah, I think his memoir was his memoir, and I don't know that it was necessarily a strict recollection of his youth. It was how he chose to remember it.
Yeah.
I think that's what the 50s was. You know, I think people did not talk about their demons and their shadows in the, right. in the 50s. And had he lived longer, it might have been interesting if he had written Act Two
yes.
to see if he really analyzed where his life went from that point.
One of the things that happens in the play, as in the book, as in real life, is that George S. Kaufman, having never acted before, suddenly decides, I want to play the playwright in this show, which seems like something fictional. That couldn't happen today, could it? Could you suddenly say, you know, I've never acted, but I'm going to get on Broadway and be in one of my plays?
Well, I know I couldn't be any good at it, so I wouldn't do it. A few people have done it once in a while. I think, you know, George Kaufman was also a critic for the New York Times. You know, it was a time when people in the theater didn't generally have just one profession,
right.
you know, and often people wrote and directed, as George Kaufman did as well. There was more of a collegial feeling, I think, amongst people in the theater that we don't have now, unfortunately. And the stakes are so much bigger than they were in those days when they had 70 theaters running, and if your play ran 100 performances, it was a hit.
So it was sort of all off-Broadway, even though it was Broadway.
Yeah, I think it wasn't as precious. I think
yeah.
people did several plays a year. Some of them were successful. Some of them weren't. Nobody's career was going to rest on whether they had a success or not. And it seems like a kind of exciting time to have been in the theater. Now everything is so goddamn important, and the fate of, you know, millions of dollars sometimes.
And sometimes careers.
And careers as well.
Yeah. There's an obvious parallel between Hart and Kaufman in the 30s and you and Stephen Sondheim in the 80s and 90s. What has made that for you a good collaboration?
You know, I think it's a little ineffable what you bring together. I think the fact that I didn't know Stephen Sondheim's work when I met him, that I'm not from the theater primarily.
And you were new to the theater at the time.
Very new to the theater. Had only directed one musical in my life. I think in many ways was kind of an advantage because I didn't have the frame of reference that he had. So I was coming from a completely different place than he had been. He's always worked in the theater. And I think maybe that was probably stimulating to him. And for me, I was just kind of a lark because I didn't really I didn't know it was going to go anywhere.
Right.
You know, I was still so new to the theater that I figured, I'll go back and be a graphic designer if this little thing doesn't turn out so well.
and so it wasn't like the Hart and Kaufman arrangement at the beginning that you depict in the play where his whole life depended on this big break.
No, nothing like that at all.
Interesting. So together you created Into the Woods and Passions, and you won a Pulitzer for Sunday in the Park with George about the painter Georges Seurat, played here in this clip by Mandy Patinkin.
White, a blank page or canvas. The challenge: bring order to the whole. Through design, composition, tension.
How did that opening scene that we just heard come about? Do you recall?
Oh, I recall exactly. I started writing this show. I brought it to Steve, and he said, well, this is so arty. I better deliver a song that an audience will have some humor in it and enjoy and tell them to sit back and relax, that it's not all going to be arty.
George.
And that's when he wrote this song.
Artists are bizarre, fixed, cold. That's you, George, you're fixed, cold. I like that in a man, fixed, cold. God is not out here. Well, there are worse things than staring at the water on a Sunday. There are worse things than staring at the water as you're posing for a picture being painted by your lover in the middle of the summer on an island in the river on a Sunday.
That's Bernadette Peters playing Seurat's disgruntled model girlfriend in Sunday in the Park with George. So for the writer, writing a book to a musical is a very different experience than writing a play, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the book writing for a musical is a craft, and it's totally underrated. It's very, very difficult to do. And if you do your job well, you'll get no recognition for it. And that's the name of the game.
Although you can – if the thing flops, you can be accused of
helping
it flop.
Oh, you're always the one to blame, you know. And even when it's successful, you rarely get any praise for it. And I don't think people understand that. Part of the nature of a musical is if it's good, it looks really easy. And you know, people are – I always said to myself, people don't come to a musical to hear the book. They come to hear the music, and that's your job, is to set up those songs and make them fly.
James Lapine, thank you very much.
Hey, real pleasure.
Act One, the play written and directed by James Lapine, is on Broadway now, and it is up for Best Play at the Tony Awards on June 8th. And a movie version of another musical that – James Lapine wrote with Stephen Sondheim, Into the Woods, comes out this Christmas. Still ahead this hour, pretty much all of our kids ask for musical instruments when they're little. But not all of us can help them become Julian Lage.
That lesson was coming from the same voice that would teach me how to tie my shoes and be a little boy. So it was, to me, it was a very holistic kind of like, yeah, you just do this with your dad. You improvise.
Right. But every kid can, almost every kid, can learn to tie his shoes. Julian Lage will perform for us just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com. The brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Julian Lage has been a professional musician for two decades. Even though he hasn't been alive for much longer than two decades, he's 26. Lage was such a prodigy that by the time he was eight, somebody'd made a documentary about him. Here he is in the documentary playing the guitar behind his head, like a little Jimi Hendrix.
Scott would love that.
He kept going, becoming a band leader and composer who's performed with players like Gary Burton, Herbie Hancock, and Bella Fleck. He has yet to put out a solo guitar record, but he's working on that right now, and he's going to play some of that work in progress for us today and talk. Julian Lage, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So where are you in the making of this album, this benchmark?
This benchmark, that's kind of true, isn't it? I would say I've written about 80% of the record. I've actually recorded the record, and upon hearing it, really want to write more.
You mean you're ostensibly done, but you just want to keep doing more?
Yeah, for the most part. Part of what's really fascinating about this project is I've been a guitar nerd my whole life, you know, obsessed with its behavior.
Yes. And so we've seen.
So you've seen. It's well documented. And in putting the spotlight so kind of directly on solo guitar, I've made some discoveries that I'm really excited about.
So will you play us something that shows off some of those discoveries?
Sure, sure, sure.
What will it be?
This is called 40s.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And that was Julian Lage playing a song called 40s off his not-quite-finished record. So that song and your music generally, I was trying to think, what's the last time somebody had a big career that wasn't folk guitar, wasn't rock guitar, wasn't really even jazz guitar? I mean, do you have a model for what it is you're trying to do and be?
Well, I think the model is very multifaceted. You know, I look at my hero since I was a little boy was Jim Hall. And, you know, in so many ways, he's known as the father of modern jazz guitar. You know, that's what I would say about him. You combine that with Bill Frisell's trajectory, a player who I admire so dearly for just the variety of things he does, and yet he's always Bill.
And I guess 100 years ago, I mean, Django Reinhardt's music was fresh and modern.
Absolutely. To this day, when I hear a lot of things in the style of Django, and then I hear Django, and I go, oh my God, this guy really didn't fit in anything. I think you hit the nail on the head. Pre-bebop jazz was a lot more wrapped up in folk music and American country music.
Yeah, the family tree had not quite split off under those branches yet.
Not at all. So in kind of peering into the past, I suppose, I've thought, wow, you know, we're at the turn of the century in a lot of ways, the way we were then, musically speaking.
Right.
So I have a vision, and I don't know how to fulfill it, but I'm working away.
And you don't know what your iTunes category should be?
No, I don't know. New music or something. Who knows?
I read that your first guitar teacher, no surprise, since you were just a little kid, was your father.
Yeah.
How old were you when he or you or both of you decided, I've gone about as far as I can with this teacher?
Well, you know, my father started playing guitar when I was about 4. So,
he had not played before that?
As a young boy, he played a little bit. Uh-huh. I have a photograph of him with an old Sears and Roebuck guitar. It's pretty wonderful. But yeah, I think it was around the time that Eric Clapton's Unplugged came out. And there were a lot of people in my father's generation who kind of had this interest that was rekindled. And, you know, I begged for a guitar. And my parents said, if you still want one when you're 5, we'll get you one. And sure enough, I wanted it more than ever. And my father took a handful of lessons, and he would show me everything he learned over that first year. He was very deliberate about making things easy for me so that I would have a better chance of sticking with it. So I used to say that lesson was coming from the same voice that would teach me how to tie my shoes and be a little boy. So to me, it was a very holistic kind of like, yeah, you just do this with your dad. You improvise.
Right. But almost every kid can learn to tie his shoes. At 5 and 6, did you think, like, why am I able to do this so much better or pick it up so much more easily than other kids?
You know, that never really crossed my mind. I'm not sure why. I think I was a little too oblivious. And the truth of the matter is that I wasn't around a lot of other young people playing guitar.
Yeah, I guess you're too young to hang out with the other guys in the garage.
You know, it's kind of that. And then, but when I was starting to do that, I was 12 and 13 and touring with Gary Burton and doing stuff like that. I guess it never felt strange. It's
But back when you were just 7, famously, Carlos Santana asked you to play with him. And you're, first of all, how did Carlos Santana find you?
He didn't find me. It's a very circuitous route. My father was working in San Francisco, and a friend of his who he knew through work said, I'm going to see Santana. I do it every year. He's a buddy of mine. You should come. You should bring Julian. So it was as simple as my parents and I getting in the car, going to this concert venue, and for some reason, this blows my mind to think about now, there was zero security. So we parked behind the stage. I mean, this was Concord Pavilion, huge place. And we drove up. We walked right in the back door. I had a guitar in my hand. And people see you with a guitar. And they say, oh, you must be looking for the green room. And say, yeah.
And probably because you were a little kid, they didn't think you were going to blow things up.
No, they didn't beat up on me too bad. They said, oh, yeah, you're probably looking for Santana, you know. So we go back, and this friend of my father says, you know, Carlos, this is Julian. And Carlos, I remember he handed me a Stratocaster and he said, well, just play something. God knows what I played. I have no idea. But he said, well, I'd love for you to sit in with us tonight. It was a double bill, him and Jeff Beck.
Wow.
And I remember my parents and I, we said, we kind of talked about it. I was kind of, I don't want to say indifferent, but I was just thrilled to be anywhere doing anything. And my parents very wisely said, you know what? That's a lot to do if you haven't, as a young child, haven't kind of emotionally prepared to step out in front of 20,000 people.
Yeah.
And so my parents came up and said, you know, thank you. It's such an honor, but maybe tonight's not the best night. He said, totally understand. Come back 1 year from now. We had no communication for a year. Sure enough, he came on tour a year later. We walked up backstage with the whole thing repeated. He said, you ready? I said, yeah, I'm ready.
And that's the video that I've seen?
That's the video.
Let's listen to that performance. And you actually look pretty mature for an 8-year-old or whatever you are, in a blazer and stuff.
I remember we got that blazer on the way to the gig at this very nice place.
Now, you can hear the crowd and going, as they're watching this little kid play guitar like this, going from, isn't that cute, surprise and laughter, to kind of more authentic appreciation for what you're doing.
Right.
Although, I don't know if I'm projecting or if it's still like, oh, that's amazing for this little kid. Was there a moment when that ended? Like, did you have to be 16 or 18?
Well, it's funny because you're young and you're doing something that's kind of extraordinary or unusual. And then that in and of itself is kind of an asset. You know, my parents and I were always we erred on the side of saying, you know, if anything like seemed like an opportunity that was exploiting the young aspect,
yeah,
it was a very easy no. You know, like, no.
Although you let him make, or your parents let them make the movie about you at 8.
Well, see, the way that came down was that was about 2 years of pursuance from the student at Stanford University. In the first handful of times, it was always no. Absolutely not. There's no, why would you make a documentary about a little boy? What do you have any interest in us for? As we came to know the director, Mark Becker, he was, you know, he's a very gifted and talented director. I mean, I think it shows more about the dichotomy of being a little boy in social environments in elementary school and trying to play guitar and be with my family.
So as you set out to write your first solo guitar record, was there a theme or a particular musical thing you were trying to accomplish?
You know, it's so interesting. It's evolved a lot. I set out to make this record because I wanted a challenge, and it was something where in growing up around solo guitar music, I hadn't felt like I had heard this one specific combination of elements. It'll sound pretty nerdy, but it's kind of a sense of guitar advocacy. Like, you just want to say, the guitar can do these things, and it's so evocative, and let me show you. And that's kind of how I feel.
Uh-huh.
And I have some friends. I have the jazz community. I have the improvisational world. I have the acoustic music component, the flat picking thing.
All on this record.
These are kind of all the components and the absurd. So the theme is really honoring the instrument in 2014, given my exposure to it, and hopefully savoring it. And hopefully that comes across.
Great. Well, I can't wait till I can have a copy. Can you give us one more song before we finish? Maybe Jig?
Yes.
Here we go. Thank you.
That's Julian Lage playing Jig off his unfinished record, and you can hear both songs that Julian played today at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget, you've still got 2 weeks left to send us your cover version of W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues. Everything you need to know is at studio360.org. Mark Anthony Thompson, also known as Chocolate Genius, will join me next month to judge the entries. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Penamaneni,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus, all on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we go out to the Aspen Ideas Festival for a science lesson.
And so now we're going to perform for you the song, Why Does the Sun Really Shine?
They might be giants. Get their facts straight.
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply...
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. The sun